Daniel Yawavietska.
Health authorities in Gaza say 9 people have been killed and at least 54 injured after Israeli forces opened fire on a crowd of civilians that had gathered to collect aid. The IDF has been approached for comment. Israel has allowed lorries containing food to enter the territory through Egypt after more deaths associated with starvation were reported and humanitarian groups warned of mass malnutrition. Cabinet will be meeting to discuss the crisis this week. Sam Rose is from the UN Agency for Palestinians, UNRWA. He says the aid is vitally needed and more needs to be done.
Countless deaths over the past few days attributed to malnutrition, attributed to dehydration, and that will continue to get worse. The entry of these food trucks alone will not suffice in terms of turning the tide on what we're facing in terms of a malnutrition crisis right now inside Gaza. We welcome these actions, but more really needs to be done.
President Trump will meet Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, for talks in Scotland later. Mr. Trump is on a 5-day working visit to 2 of his golf courses. He meets the Prime Minister tomorrow for discussions about how to increase trade. 6 firefighters in Greece have been taken to hospital with burns and smoke inhalation as wildfires continue in several parts of the country for a second day. Firefighters from the Czech Republic and Italian aircraft are going to join the effort. The main front has been contained, however, scattered hotspots continue to burn. Resident doctors are taking part in a 3rd consecutive day of strikes in England as part of a 5-day walkout over pay. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has insisted disruption will be kept to a minimum, but thousands of appointments have been postponed. NHS England says hospitals are aiming to reschedule them within 2 weeks, but has warned of knock-on effects for other patients. And the Prince of Wales has issued a good luck message to England's Lionesses ahead of their showdown with Spain in the final of the Women's European Football Championship this afternoon. A look now at the weather. Mostly cloudy across the UK with brighter spells in the far north and southeast. Showers are possible in some places, but it will be mainly dry. And that's the BBC News and weather at 12:02. You're listening to Radio 3. It's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The American director and choreographer Kathleen Marshall has been nominated for 9 Tony Awards, winning 3 times for Broadway productions of Wonderful Town, The Pajama Game, and Anything Goes. She was the first woman to complete a trio of achievements, directing a play, directing a musical, and choreographing a musical on Broadway. She also won an Olivier Award for her 2021 production of Anything Goes in London. It was the first big musical to open after numerous COVID lockdowns and received an ecstatic welcome from audiences and critics alike, hungry to get back into a theatre and enjoy a hugely uplifting show. Kathleen, you're currently directing Irving Berlin's Top Hat in Chichester, and you certainly brought a toe-tapping mix of music today, including Mozart, Chopin, and Tchaikovsky. But I think we're going to start with Duke Ellington.
Yes, Daybreak Express. I love this piece. It's just an instrumental piece, and it sounds like a train starting up. And the close harmonies in the arrangement and the playing by the horns and the brass, it's so cool. I just think it's so evocative.
Thank you.
It's wild.
It's so fun. And what I love is that those aren't sound effects. Those are all musicians playing instruments in a very complicated arrangement.
Yeah. It reminded me a bit of Bernstein's Prelude, Fugue and Riffs, which does the same kind of thing, sort of goes crazy. And do you know a piece by Arthur Honegger called Pacific 231?
No.
You'd like it because it is exactly about a train starting, you know, very slowly, chug, chug, chug. And then it just gets faster and faster, but it's a very exciting piece. Daybreak Express, composed and performed by Duke Ellington and his orchestra. Tell me a little bit about your early life, Kathleen Marshall. I think you grew up in Pittsburgh.
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My parents, both academics, college professors and educators, and took us to see everything. You know, I have a brother and sister who were a couple years older than me who were twins. And, you know, Pittsburgh was sort of a wonderful medium-sized city, so it had everything. It had an opera company, a symphony, a ballet company, you know, and they took us to see everything, including, you know, Shakespeare and symphonies and operas and ballets, but we loved the musicals the best.
What was the first Broadway show that struck you?
Well, I remember as a kid in Pittsburgh, they had an outdoor, at that time, it was Pittsburgh Civic Light Opera. At first, it was an outdoor theater. And I remember seeing Oklahoma as a kid. And I also remember in the summer going to visit my grandparents in Boston, and we went to something called the South Shore Music Circus and saw Oliver. And that, of course, when you're a kid, seeing kids on stage, that's really, really memorable.
Previn worked in Pittsburgh.
Yes, Andre Previn. Yes, he was the conductor of the Pittsburgh Symphony for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he is one of those wonderful American composers who can kind of write streetwise music as well as classical.
Yeah, all his movie scores and everything, yeah.
Did you know when you began to see that Broadway shows that this was something that you might take up?
You know, I think, like a lot of people, I was sort of a fan before I ever thought it was something I could participate in. And then, actually, when we were kids, that same Pittsburgh Civic Light Opera Company, my brother and sister and I, all before we'd ever had lessons or any really formal training, we all auditioned and we all were kids in The Sound of Music. We were three of the Von Trapp kids. Even though we were just amateurs in a way, we were in a professional production, and it really sort of got us excited about to see how it all is put together. This was interesting. The director, Milton Lyon, was the director and the musical director, if you can imagine that. And he brought the kids in. We were the last show of the season, but he brought us in all summer to sort of get us ready for the show. And in between rehearsals, we'd go watch the other shows rehearsing. And I think that's where I really sort of got the bug and wanted to sort of learn to dance.
You sound a bit like the Von Trapp family.
Yeah, we were. There was a lot of singing in the car on long road trips.
I think the next piece of music we're going to hear, wonderful piece, but it reminds you particularly of your mum.
Yes, my mother is a big opera fan, and we listened to a lot of opera growing up and took us to see a lot of operas. And so I picked the overture from The Marriage of Figaro just because I love the energy of it and the attack of it. And it's sort of just, it's so joyful. I don't think you can listen to it and not smile.
Thank you. The Overture from The Marriage of Figaro, a wonderfully sort of, well, as I said, we were having foot-tapping music. That yes. really gets one off to a start.
Oh, yes, it? And I love when you see it live and you see that string section sort of all in sync with those fast, fast bowing, and it's so exciting, it's so energetic.
There's a kind of tactile feel, isn't there, from seeing strings
yes.
Really hitting with
yeah,
the bow.
And perfectly in sync, their bows going up and down. It's great. Yeah.
Do you think that was the right speed? Because I know you've been at performances, Kathleen, where people weren't happy with it.
I saw a performance of The Marriage of Figaro years ago at the Vienna Opera House, and it was beautiful production. At the end, the audience was cheering and cheering, and then the conductor came out, and the audience booed. And I asked the person, I was like, why are they booing him? And she said, because they thought he took the overture too fast. And I thought, how can you possibly take it too fast?
It's marked quite fast. Well, there we heard the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by the wonderful Charles McCarris, playing the overture from The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart, and I thought that was pretty spot on. So when did you first start dancing then?
I started a little late. I didn't start till I was 13. I thought ballet class was for like snobby little girls on Saturday mornings, and I tried gymnastics, and I was absolutely terrible at gymnastics. I couldn't do any of the tumbling, but I could do the moves in between the tumbling. So I thought, okay, I'll try this. And then it just kind of, I don't know how when you first started playing piano, it's like when I first started taking ballet, it just kind of fit, like kids who sort of can pick up a drumsticks and it just fits them, you know.
So a relatively late starter.
Yeah, but then within a couple of years, I was taking classes 5 days a week, ballet, jazz, tap, point, the whole nine yards.
Having academic parents, Kathleen, did that mean you were an academic child?
Well, I went to Smith College in Massachusetts, and I studied English literature. And at the same time, I was doing dance there as well. There was a wonderful woman named Jemsy DeLapp who had been one of Agnes de Mille's dancers and assistants and worked with Jerome Robbins. She was the original Simon of Legree in The King and I. She was in the original Painter Wagon. She danced at American Ballet Theater. It was incredible to work with her.
What was Jemsy DeLapp like as a teacher?
She was extraordinary because she would teach us ballet technique class, but then she also taught musical theater history. She taught musical theater choreography. We actually did the Carousel Ballet as a concert, and Agnes Mill was still with us then, so we had to get permission from Miss DeMille to do it. We had to promise we would never teach it or replicate it anywhere else. But I remember Jemsy teaching me Louise's solo at the beginning of the ballet. And it was extraordinary because she didn't tell me steps or counts. She just danced to the music, and she told me what she was thinking. You know, looking out to the sea, or that she was yearning, or that she was sort of feeling lost, or she would just sort of give us the emotional context of what was going through Louise's mind.
And so what piece have you chosen from that period?
So, well, Les Sylphides by Chopin. Parts of Les Sylphides are used for ballet all the time. I think we've all done pliés to and tendus at the bar to all, many variations from Les Sylphides. And then also when I was at college, at Smith College, we did Les Sylphides in concert because Jemsy had worked with Fokine and recreated the Fokine choreography for us. And to get to perform that choreography, it was really great.
Thank you.
so beautiful, isn't it? And I can just sort of see the sautés and sautés that you have to do. It's very, because the choreography is very buoyant, yeah, since the music's very buoyant.
Well, I'm no dancer, but I couldn't help swaying in
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
We heard the finale of Les Sylphides, music by Chopin, arranged by Roy Douglas, and performed by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Kathleen Marshall, how did you get your first break as a professional choreographer?
Well, it was really through my brother Rob Marshall, who's a director and choreographer, who's directed a few movies you might have heard of, like Chicago and Into the Woods and Mary Poppins Returns and The Little Mermaid. And he, like me, was a dancer and a performer. He started working with Graziella Danielle, assisting her. And then his first big Broadway show was Kiss of the Spider Woman, directed by Hal Prince, with music by Kandra Ebb, a book by Terrence McNally. And Rob was the choreographer, and I assisted him on that. So that was wonderful. And then it was actually through John Kander, who had a friend who was doing a show, a little musical review, and they needed a choreographer, and John Kander recommended me. That was a little review called Swinging on a Star, which had a couple regional productions in New York, but ended up on Broadway, and that was my first Broadway show as a choreographer.
Can you describe a little bit the process of, as it were, writing choreography? I mean, how do you come up with ideas?
You know, I always feel it's like a spiral, and you sort of have to go around and around and around until you sort of get to the center. And it's a combination of, you know, the character, the story, the music. And it depends on whether you're sort of creating new dance arrangements, like I've done for a lot of Broadway shows, or if you're working with existing arrangements. Like when I did Wonderful Town, you know, we used all of the existing arrangements because they were all done by Bernstein. You know, he didn't really have a dance arranger. He did them all himself. So then you're sort of drawing between the lines and listening to the music and sort of figuring out what's the story, who are the characters, what's the emotion, what's the mood of the story at that point. And then I feel like the steps are kind of the last thing that come once you sort of figure out the who and the why.
Do you enjoy the collaborative thing of working with dancers, directors, musicians?
Oh, very much so. I sort of, it's interesting because we're in rehearsals for Top Hat now and we're three quarters of the way through staging the show, but we've got a couple of big numbers to go. But it's so much easier to create once you're in the room with everybody. You know, before you start rehearsals and you're just sort of making things up on your own, it's sort of hard. But once you're in a room with people and such talented people, it's very inspirational.
And do you like it when they feed in ideas? Like, how about if we were to do this?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. It's great when you have, I always feel like the best idea in the room should win. So it's great when you're in a room with really creative people.
You and Rob, your brother, collaborated on a number of shows together. That must have been fun, but it must have been also hard to break away and do something on your own.
It was very fun working with him and assisting my brother on three or four Broadway shows and then working as a choreographer with various directors. It's wonderful because it's like an apprentice art. You know, I sort of got to see how directors and writers, how they work with composers and lyricists and book writers, how they talk to designers, how they run an audition, how they run a production meeting, how they run a technical rehearsal. So you get this wonderful sort of observership of how everybody sort of works to figure out, you know, how you want to run a room.
You became artistic director for the Encores from 1996 to 2000. What did that involve?
So the Encore series in New York is at City Center, and the idea was to sort of hear musicals in their original form. The original idea was, we sort of joked and called it Flops by Tops, which is like, well, what are the Rodgers and Hammerstein or Lerner and Lowe shows or Irving Berlin or Cole Porter shows that are sort of not done all the time? And the thought was to sort of do a kind of semi-staged concert version of those musicals, but with the original arrangements and orchestrations and a full orchestra. And so that was really fun to sort of get to hear lesser-known shows. Like the first one I ever choreographed was Call Me Madam. So, you know, Irving Berlin show that maybe doesn't get done a lot, but to hear those original arrangements and songs and orchestrations with a full 28-piece orchestra is great.
And did it breathe new life into some of these? Did some of them take off as a result?
Yes. Wonderful Town, which I directed and choreographed at Encores, then transferred to Broadway. The Chicago revival that's still running started as a concert at Encores.
That's a wonderful idea, actually. I wish that applied to all kinds of other art forms and pieces of music. A classic song by Irving Berlin now, which unusually didn't feature in one of his musicals.
No, Always is this beautiful song.
This was written as a wedding gift for his wife, wasn't it?
Yes, and the reason I chose this version sung by Kelly O'Hara is Kelly sang it at our wedding to my husband, Scott Landis. And we'd both worked with her on The Pajama Game and on Nice Brief We Can Get It. My husband's a producer. And we found this verse. There's a first verse to Always, which is kind of a little downer. And then we found the second verse to Always, which is actually quite beautiful and quite positive. And it was interesting because after she sang it at our wedding, and then after that is when she made this recording. So I'd like to think that we helped her find this song.
Dreams will all come true, growing old with you, and time will fly, caring each day more than the day before, till spring rolls by. And when the spring
Oh, Kelly's voice is just so gorgeous, so beautiful. And, you know, she's from Oklahoma, so I love that that arrangement has a sort of gentle country twang, a little Patsy Cline to it.
It's quite an extraordinary voice, actually,
yeah.
She's got, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And you know, she sings opera. She sung at the Met, Broadway, and did King and I, you know, here in London, and she's extraordinary.
We heard Always by Irving Berlin, performed by Kelly O'Hara. What made you decide to go for Wonderful Town as your first directing job?
You know, I think it really is the music. I mean, I think that Bernstein music is so sort of beautiful and exciting, and it sort of has everything. It's got really clever character songs with great Compton and Green clever lyrics like 100 Easy Ways. It's got beautiful ballads like Quiet Girl. And then just the excitement of the arrangements of something like The Village Vortex or Conquering New York or Christopher Street. The music is thrilling.
Actually, there's an autobiographical element almost to the story, isn't it? Because, okay, it's not a brother, but it's two sisters who aspire to be a writer and actress.
Yeah, oh yes. I think that's, you know, for everybody who's not from New York and comes to New York to sort of be creative and sort of enter into an artistic world, or we all have that sense of the excitement of arriving in New York.
What kind of things do you feel you have to bear in mind when reviving old musicals for modern audiences?
That's a great question. I always feel like with the musical, you're dealing with, especially revival, you're dealing with three time periods. You're dealing with when it was written, when it was set, and today. So something like Top Hat, when the movie came out in 1935, it was contemporary. And all songs, all, you know, the five songs from the show all hit the top of the charts. And then doing it now, we're still set in 1935. So we're doing, it's a period piece for us. And I think you have to be aware that you don't want to do anything anachronistic, but you want to create the same experience for an audience in 2025 that the audience at 1935 had when they saw the movie. The sense of escaping into this impossibly glamorous world and elegant world and romantic world and the sort of the farce of the comedy and the gorgeous songs and all of that. You sort of want to escape into this glamorous world. And we sort of want to do the same for an audience in 2025 at Chichester. We want them to sort of enter into the theater and then escape into this beautiful world.
Wonderful Town was so well received that it led to a full revival and transferred to Broadway towards the end, starring Brooke Shields as Ruth. That must have been very satisfying to feel you'd helped this great piece back into life.
Oh, yeah, it was wonderful. And, you know, when we did it at Encores, Betty Comden and Adolph Green were both still with us, who, of course, wrote the lyrics. Incredible team who sort of wrote the screenplay to The Bandwagon, wrote the screenplay to Singin' in the Rain, besides all the sort of Broadway musicals that they wrote book and lyrics to as well. Just extraordinary. And, of course, wrote New York, New York, the first New York, New York from On the Town. So Betty and Adolph were there when we did the production at Encores. By the time it transferred to New York, Adolph had passed away, but Betty was still with us. And it was her first Broadway opening without Adolph by her side. And she was very emotional about it, but she was also thrilled that this was the first Broadway revival of Wonderful Town. And it was wonderful to see that a period piece could still have that kind of impact on an audience.
Well, of course, the great thing is you can't keep a great tune down, can you? I mean, if you've got that, you're halfway there.
Oh, yeah. And I think, you know, the conga at the end of the first act is sort of just so insane. And, you know, the music and the lyrics and sort of the situation is so crazy and absurd. And it just leads to this kind of musical comedy heaven. One more thing about Betty. If you called Betty's home number in New York and you got her answering machine, it was just Betty going, New York, New York, a hell of a town. Beep.
Wonderful. It's incredibly expensive, Kathleen, to put a show on Broadway. Was the financial risk something you worried about? Do you worry about it?
Well, I think, you know, you definitely sort of have to feel responsible, right? You sort of feel like you don't want to create a show that is impossible to run, that is so expensive. So it's certainly that something that we always work with producers in terms of what's the size of the cast and the orchestra, what's the physical production, but we all want to have something we can sustain.
And I suppose people judge these things by how long they run, don't they?
Yeah. You know, classic musicals in the 30s, 40s, and 50s would run a season, and they would consider successful. And I think now people are waiting for that next international blockbuster. You know, what's going to run for 10 years in the West End and 10 years on Broadway and have international tours all over the world. And that's a lot of pressure. And I think that, you know, there was a time when plays and musicals would run a season, and that was fine. And that was seen as successful.
So one should take heart.
Yes.
Benny Goodman next.
Yes. Sing, Sing, Sing. This is just, it was written by Louis Prima, but I think the version that most people know is the Benny Goodman recording, which is just so much fun. And I of course, all I can think of is Bob Fosse's choreography from Dancin'. And when you get to that final movement of it, that just builds and builds. And it's interesting because sometimes a dance arranger that I work with, David Chase, we talk about at the end of a musical number. And actually when we did Too Darn Hot, and Kiss Me, Kate, and he did a new arrangement for it, we sort of emulated the end of Sing, 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 because it goes around and around, and then it goes around and around, and it goes an octave higher and an octave higher, and it sort of kind of can't stand it, sort of is just to build the excitement, and then it sort of explodes at the end.
Mm-hmm.
It's so thrilling, that end. It's just revs and revs and revs, and that Gene Krupa drums. I mean, it's just, actually just in rehearsal the other day, I said, you know, give us some Krupa drums, meaning those sort of low toms, and it's just so cool and so sexy. I love it.
And it's almost as though at the end, what do? We just stop.
Yeah. Actually, it's sort of, I love that it ends up. You know, as opposed to a lot of things that button down, and this is ba-dum, it ends up. Yeah.
Sing, Sing, Sing by Louis Prima, performed by the Benny Goodman Orchestra. You're listening to Private Passions with me, Michael Barclay, and my guest today, the director and choreographer, Kathleen Marshall. The Pajama Gang, Kathleen, was your next success in 2006. Of course, it had been a huge hit when first performed half a century earlier.
Yes, that was with Kelly O'Hara and Harry Connick Jr. And again, it was really fun because I think people didn't expect, they thought it would be sort of quaint and sort of sweet. And we kind of made it a little more sexy and muscular. And I think people were surprised. And Kelly and Harry were just amazing. And their chemistry was just phenomenal. And so it was a nice surprise. And we ended up winning the Tony for Best Revival, which nobody expected us to do.
Well, I can see that the story about a love affair complicated by a labour dispute in a pyjama factory could be updated to what's going on in the world.
Yes, it's true. We sort of kept it set in the 50s, but I think it's also important when you do these kind of vintage musicals to sort of, even if it's a musical comedy, to sort of treat it seriously. You know, you have to sort of treat the characters as real people, and their problems are real problems, and their obstacles are real obstacles. And then you can still surround that with sort of delight and joy and humor and silliness and music and dancing.
It was the debut of Harry Connick Jr. on Broadway, wasn't it?
Yes, I think he'd done some concerts on Broadway, but this was his first time playing a character on Broadway. And he'd done movies, he'd been on Will and Grace, so he'd, you know, done a lot of acting. But whenever he performed live, he performed as himself. In his concerts, of course, he could mix it up and do whatever he wanted. And so I had a conversation with him, and I thought, well, you know, he's used to being able to not having to do the same thing every show, that he can mix it up when he does his own concerts. So I had this crazy idea. I thought, if I can get him to a piano at some point where he can have a little section to improvise every evening. So we devised this crazy thing in Hernando's Hideaway, that he got to Hernando's Hideaway and he started playing the piano. And so he had one section of the show that was improvisational every night. And I thought, that'll give him a little freedom. And it was also sort of thrilling to find a way for him to show off his piano skills in the middle of the show.
Was he happy that he could do that? Did it make a difference to him, do you think?
I think so. I think it gave him just a little sort of elbow room that he didn't have to do the exact same show every night.
Mm-hmm. Handel next.
Yes. So the Hallelujah Chorus, I love the tradition that whenever it plays, that everybody stands and sings along. We used to go to these Christmas concerts, these holiday concerts every year in Pittsburgh at actually something called the Carnegie Music Hall, not Carnegie Hall, New York, but Andrew Carnegie, who made his fortune in Pittsburgh, built a beautiful music hall. Every year there were these beautiful Christmas concerts, and it always ended with the Hallelujah Chorus, and everybody stood and everybody sung along. And I just thought that's such a wonderful, beautiful tradition.
Well, feel free to stand if the mood takes you.
Thank you.
tell you, that Handel knew how to do a big finish. I love that vocal arrangement. I love the "And He Shall Reign" when it stacks from like the baritones to the tenors to the altos to the sopranos. And then that King of Kings, the sopranos just keep going higher and higher. You think they can't go any higher, and they keep going.
The Hallelujah Chorus from The Messiah by Handel, performed by the Polyphony Choir and the Britain Symphonia Orchestra, conducted by Stephen Layton. In 2011, Kathleen Marshall, you decided to revive Anything Goes, a somewhat madcap adventure aboard an ocean liner bound from New York to London.
Yes. Yes, we did that at the Roundabout Theatre Company with Sutton Foster. But I sort of felt a responsibility because Anything Goes, unlike Wonderful Town, has had many productions and people have seen many productions and have great affection for the show. So I thought, well, we have a responsibility to sort of deliver the show people know and love, but also try to find ways to give them something new and something fresh and something a little unexpected as well.
So how did you go about that?
Well, luckily we had Sutton Foster, who is a triple threat. And as you know, she then performed Anything Goes here at the Barbican. And because she really is a triple threat who can do anything. I mean, I think a lot of times you see productions of Anything Goes where the dancing starts and Reno Sweeney steps aside and then rejoins at the end to sing the big finish. But Sutton, who is an extraordinary dancer and comedian and actress and singer, we were able to create really exciting choreography for her.
It's part of your role as choreographer to create challenges for star performances.
Yes. Well, you know, with Sutton, when we did the title number for Anything Goes, we didn't know how long it was going to be when we started off. We just sort of, when I was working with David Chase, the dance arranger, we just kept coming up with new sort of sections and new ideas. And as I was teaching it and working with Sutton on it, I kept saying to her, you know, we can take you out of sections. We can give you a breather. We can let somebody else take over. And she was like, no, let's keep going. Let's keep going. And we kept going. And she danced the whole number, which I think is like 8 minutes long or something insane. And then she comes back singing at the end and ends with this big high note. And so it really is sort of a real physical challenge for her.
The story captures the spirit of the 1930s after Prohibition was repealed and people were seeking escapism, adventure. Do you enjoy researching the era in which a musical is set? I mean, where do you look for inspiration?
Oh, very much so. I love... Well, now, of course, you can see everything on YouTube, but I used to always go to the Lincoln Center Library of Performing Arts that has something called the Jerome Robbins Archive. You know, for instance, doing Anything Goes, I would look at period dancing from the 1930s, from swing dancing, social dancing, movie musicals from that era, just to sort of capture a sense of the style. And there's a difference between social dancing is different than theatrical choreography, so you have to just take the core of that social dancing and then heighten it to turn it into something theatrical.
The London production in 2021 was the first big musical to open after the numerous lockdowns. And I think that led to the audience's ecstatic response because it was as though they had been set free as well as the cast. People returned to the theatre once again. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes. I will never forget our first preview at the Barbican of Anything Goes. And their shows had been open, but with a limited audience, like a one-third capacity. And our producer, Howard Panter, was very smart to say, we're not going to open till we can be at 100% capacity. So he delayed our opening. And it was packed, packed. Every, you know, most people wearing masks. But just the release and the joy, the number Blow, Gabriel, Blow, which in the show comes at a time, you know, it's a sort of... Reno Sweeney is an evangelist slash nightclub performer, and it's kind of her show, but it turns into a spontaneous kind of revival meeting. And the way we sort of think about it in the show is that all the characters at that point need release. They all have some kind of tension or something that they need to happen or need not to happen. They're all at a point of crisis, and that song acts like a release. And what was incredible is that we gave that same release to the audience. At the end of Blow, Gabriel, Blow, we got a standing ovation in the middle of the second act because I think people were just so relieved. And to have the sort of musical and community experience and communal experience of everybody in the same room experiencing the joy of live theater once again was just a release for everybody.
Your next piece of music is about communal joy too, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, a little bit on the Christmas theme. I love Christmas so much. And we call my husband Christmas Boy because he loves Christmas so much. And so Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, which of course was introduced by Judy Garland in the film Meet Me in St. Louis. But there's this young artist named Samara Joy, who is a young American jazz singer. I think she's only like 25 years old, and she is extraordinary. She burst on the scene a couple of years ago, won a Sarah Vaughan Award, and has won several Grammys now. And it's just extraordinary. She's a young person, but her voice is just so rich and so emotional. I think she's just incredible.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself year old. Someday soon, we all will be together. If the fates allow, until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. So have yourself a merry
extraordinary. Yeah. What an incredible voice.
I like the way she sort of scattered over the last few lines.
Yeah, and it's not written as a waltz, but she sort of, that arrangement is a jazz waltz, which is so beautiful.
We heard Samara Joy, and she certainly is making waves. She was at the Proms just recently.
Oh, that's so incredible. I'm so jealous. I've never seen her live.
Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas by Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine, and performed by Samara Joy. Kathleen Marshall, the cast of Anything Goes in London included Felicity Kendall, highly experienced stage and television actress. But this was her first appearance in a musical, I think, in her 70s. How did you approach working with her?
Oh, she was a delight. Oh, my gosh, I love Felicity so much. And, you know, she played Mrs. Harcourt, Hope's mother. So it's really, there's not much singing to that role, just a sort of little bit and a little bit of dancing in the sort of finale and the curtain call. But she was such a delight. And Just the most wonderful woman. And also what I love is that she's somebody who sort of approached the comedy very seriously. Even though it's a sort of absurd farce, she gave it a backbone of reality. And she's so elegant and so beautiful. And she's just as lovely offstage as she is on stage.
How do you build confidence for performers who aren't necessarily highly trained singers or indeed dancers?
Well, you know, choreography is so difficult because you can prepare for a scene or a song. You can have your script and your score. You can have already learned the melodies. You can have looked at the script and already have a sort of sense of who this character is, and you know your lines. For choreography, there's no way to do it except for in the room when you go, okay, let's go left foot on two, you know? And so it's sometimes hard because I think actors, they want to, you know, get it right. And it's like there's no way to work on choreography except for just do it over and over and over and over again until it becomes really comfortable.
I think that prompt would have been appropriate for me. Two left feet. When you're casting more generally, what are you looking for?
I think what we mostly look for is people who are sort of vivid and unique. You know, obviously there's a certain level of skill you have to be a musical theater performer in terms of dancing and singing and acting. But beyond that, you want people who are sort of really interesting, people who sort of hold your eye. And I love people who sort of bring their own individuality and their own personality to their performing. And I think there's a difference between, you know, something like Anything Goes and Top Hat, where we're sort of populating the show with a wide variety of people. It's not like we're sort of doing, you know, the Rockettes. You know, there's a difference between what I call sort of unison dancing and precision dancing. Precision dancing is the Rockettes, you know, that it's very uniform. Where unison dancing, we can be all shapes and sizes and ages, and yet we're all sort of dancing the same choreography because we're all feeling the same emotion at the same time.
Something that's always intrigued me is the difficulty or the advantages of having people who are classically trained. Because in a way, you don't want a sort of can belto singer, do you, in a musical. But on the other hand, it's very useful to have somebody who can read music. So
yes.
How do you find that?
It's a real balance. I mean, of course, musical theater is such a hybrid, right? Because you're taking all the sort of art forms of opera and ballet and classical theater and combining it into one and creating its own art form. And what's wonderful is when you see, you know, with Top Hat now, with our leads, Philip Atmore and Lucy St. Louis and Clive Carter and Sally Ann Triplett, who are all sort of really experienced musical theater actors, and they just get it. They understand the tone. They understand that you're creating a reality, but it's a heightened reality because you've got to figure out a way to go from a scene into a song and make it feel like it's natural. You're playing a scene, but you're also aware that you're creating the rhythm and the experience for the audience, really, that you have to sort of make sure that everything you're doing reads and lands. And so it's really amazing to see.
Well, actually, this is a rather good moment to mention, given what you were just saying, plays, because you directed Living on Love, a comedy about an opera diva,
yes,
played by Renee Fleming.
Yes.
Was that enjoyable, and was it fun to do that comedy on the stage?
Yes, very fun. It was Renee Fleming's first play. We did it at the Williamstown Theatre Festival, and then it came to Broadway. And yes, she was playing a sort of opera diva who was having a marriage crisis with her Italian maestro husband. And she was great. Her timing was so perfect, and we found little places for her to sing. As we went along, we kept making adjustments in the script and changing lines, and she was sort of astonished by that because, of course, in opera, you can't change a note. You can't change a word. And so it was really fun for her because she got to really participate in the creation of it.
Well, music, of course, is woven throughout the play. And I wonder whether you've ever thought of directing an opera yourself.
You know what? I would be fascinated to do that. Probably a comic opera would be more my...
Janoski.
Yes. And so the next song we have is Puccini's O Mio Bambino Caro. But I just love this aria so much. And I think there's a reason why we've heard this aria so much in film soundtracks and, you know, everywhere. Because I think it's just the pure beauty of melody and how emotional melody can make you feel.
Thank you.
So beautiful.
You have to have a sensitive conductor there, taking account of how long the soprano wants to hold that.
Yes, yes, because it has to have that taffy pull to it. So do you think Puccini knew, do you think when he put down his pen after he wrote that, do you think he knew he'd written something absolutely that stunningly gorgeous? I don't know.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think sometimes composers do know that certainly hits the spot for me, and so maybe it will for other people.
Yeah.
We heard O mio bambino caro from the opera Gianneschichi, and it's performed by Renata Tebaldi very beautifully, and the Del Maggio Musicale Florentino Orchestra, conducted by Lamberto Gardelli, who often conducted at Covent Garden and was very used to supporting singers. What, Kathleen Marshall, is your favourite part of the rehearsal process as a director?
First of all, the first day, you know, when everybody gets together and we read through the script for the first time, that's one of my favorites. But my absolute favorite is what we call the Sitzprobe, German term, but it means when we put the orchestra and the cast together for the first time. It's usually a sort of, you know, one 3-hour rehearsal one day, and the cast gets to hear the full orchestra for the first time. And it's so exciting for everybody. It's my favorite day.
It's the moment also for the singers where they're suddenly given a carpet of sound underneath them, aren't they? They've had a piano up until then, but now there's this rich orchestration.
Yeah.
And from which they can take flight. you're dealing with many departments when you're directing huge productions, costumes, set design, props. How do you juggle all those competing concerns?
I remember the first time I worked on a film, which is sort of even more complicated than a stage production, and it seemed sort of impossible. Like, how do you attack this? And somebody said, well, how do you eat a car? And the answer is one bite at a time. I think the first thing is to surround yourself with the most brilliant people you can. And so we have an incredible design team, music team. Gareth Valentine is our music supervisor, who is sort of one of the most beloved and experienced musical directors in the world. And so, you know, I think it's always important to sort of have a wonderful team and to get everybody's ideas. You know, I always feel like I hope if I'm sort of going off the rails that somebody will perform an intervention.
You're currently directing Top Hat, as we mentioned, at Chichester Theatre, based on the classic 1935 film which starred Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Many in your audience for Top Hat will, of course, know and absolutely love the screen performance. Does that affect how you present the show? Do they cast a long shadow, and do you acknowledge an influence or want to try something quite new?
Well, luckily, we have two extraordinary lead performers, Philip Atmore and Lucy St. Louis, who are triple threat, amazing performers, and gorgeous, and their chemistry together is amazing. And yes, of course, the classic numbers from Top Hat sort of still exist, and we can watch them over and over again. And I think what we want to do is sort of emulate a little bit of that feel, but then take it a step further. So what's wonderful is that there are many songs in the musical of Top Hat that aren't in the film, so that really is sort of fresh territory for us to explore something new.
Top Hat's famous for numbers like Let's Face the Music and Dance and Putting on the Ritz. Was it those that attracted you to it?
Oh, you know, there's just everything Irving Berlin wrote. I mean, Cole Porter has a famous quote. He was asked, what is Irving Berlin's place in American music? And he said, Irving Berlin is American music. but I think I chose Cheek to Cheek because I think there's just something so swoony about it. And I don't think there's anybody who hasn't ever been on a dance floor in classic dance position and hasn't immediately thought to themselves, heaven, I'm in heaven. I mean, it's just the best opening line of a song ever.
Well, I hope hearing the music is balm to your soul, because, of course, you have twins, don't you?
Yes.
Ellen and Nathaniel.
Yeah.
And you have to be away from them for such a long time.
I know. My twins, Ellen and Nathaniel, they just turned 15 just before I came over to London to do Top Hat, and love them so much, miss them so much. Thank you for mentioning them. You know, it's hard to be away from home, but it's, in a way, it's also creating such a big musical. In a way, there's some advantages to not having the responsibilities of home and husband and children and dog, because I can just focus on Top Hat.
Well, we can imagine you all cheek to cheek.
Yes, thank you.
Heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak. And I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Heaven, I'm in heaven, and the cares that hung around me through the week seem to vanish like a gambler's lucky streak when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love to climb a mountain and to reach the highest peak, but it doesn't thrill me half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love to go out fishing in a river or a creek, but I don't enjoy it half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. Dance with me, I want my arm about you, the charm about you will carry me through to heaven. I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek.
So great. You know, it's Fred Astaire. There was a famous screen test that he did. In his first screen test, the notes were can't sing, can't act, is balding, can dance a little. But what's extraordinary is the number of composers who wrote songs for him that he introduced. Irving Berlin, the Gershwins, Jerome Kern, Dorothy Fields. When you look back, so many classic songs from the American Songbook were introduced by Fred Astaire in his films.
It is fascinating because I was thinking as we were listening that it's not in the classical sense a great voice or even in the pop voice, but he has such artistry.
Yeah.
What he brings to it is inimical, isn't
it? Oh, yeah.
Cheek to Cheek from Top Hat by Irving Berlin, performed by Fred Astaire and the Leo Reisman Orchestra. Kathleen Marshall, do you feel that the world of musicals has changed dramatically since you first started out?
I think, you know, it's interesting. The economics of live theater are sort of tricky, as you said earlier. And I think most big musicals these days are revivals, a revival of Sweeney Todd or Ragtime or Anything Goes, because you have a sort of known quantity that you feel like you can have an audience for. Because so many new musicals these days start off Broadway or in regional theaters, and they're sort of fun home size. Or, I mean, look at maybe Happy Ending that just won the Tony Award as a four people on stage. So it's interesting that people are in a world of creating musicals that are smaller because there's maybe a greater possibility that they can get produced and maybe a greater possibility that they can sustain. It's just like plays. Nobody's writing three-act plays like Kaufman and Hart with a cast of 20 people in them because it's just economically difficult to do.
To any young aspiring performers, choreographers who dream of one day working on Broadway, what advice would you give?
Just be involved in it as much as you can. I mean, you know, what we're doing on Broadway and in the West End and in Chichester is the same as putting on any show anywhere, whether it's in your living room for your parents or in your backyard with your friends or at your high school or your college. It's all the same process. You're just getting in a room with people and coming up with something. So I sort of feel like do that as much as you can at whatever level you can. You know, as Lin-Manuel wrote, you want to be in the room where it happens. You know, get in the room and watch other people putting it together.
What is your final piece, Kathleen?
Well, the last thing we have is The Waltz of the Snowflakes from The Nutcracker by Tchaikovsky, which I think is just the most extraordinary music. I love the children's choir that comes in. It just builds to this incredible climax. And if you've ever seen the George Balanchine production of The Nutcracker, it's the end of the first act, and it just keeps building and building, and the snow keeps falling and swirling, and I don't know how the dancers are dancing on point as the snow is collecting all around their feet. And then, of course, in his production, it ends with they get in a sort of sleigh and they fly off to the land of the Swedes. And it's just musically, visually, choreographically, design, it's all just reaches this incredible climax.
Well, it's pretty well performed here too, because we've got the Berlin Philharmonic and the Libera Choir conducted by Simon Rattle. Kathleen Marshall, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Waltz of the Snowflakes from The Nutcracker by Tchaikovsky, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic and the Libera Choir, conducted by Simon Rattle. It was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the director and choreographer Kathleen Marshall. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. We're off on a musical journey next this afternoon on Radio 3 to explore some jazz-influenced Shostakovich for banjo and electric Hawaiian lap guitar. Stay tuned, if for nothing else, to find out what one of those actually is. Music Map is after this.
BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms.
Fate knocks loudly at the door in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Answered with defiant musical optimism. A timeless masterpiece, resonating with power and drama. Join me, Ian Skelly, live from the Royal Albert Hall with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra and conductor Maxim Emelianichev. The BBC Proms, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Available now on BBC Sound.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3 this Sunday afternoon. We're now at just gone 1:30. It's time to go travelling with Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where a single piece of classical music is both the end of a musical journey and the starting point for a web of sonic connections. And today, we're working our way towards the first of Dmitri Shostakovich's suites for jazz orchestra. Shostakovich wrote this first suite for a small jazz orchestra, more like a band, in 1934. And to start today's Music Map, we're going to listen to another very similar waltz that comes from his second jazz suite. Except it doesn't. He did write a second suite a couple of years later, but it was lost. And for a long time, the thing that was called the second jazz suite was in fact a collection of Shostakovich's tunes arranged by someone else in the 50s for a large variety orchestra. And it's that waltz which Stanley Kubrick made famous with his film Eyes Wide Shut.